DW, Living Planet, with Sam Baker.
Welcome to the show. Today, we're hearing from women in the Niger Delta who are dealing with environmental degradation.
When there's no money, the situation is hunger, sickness, poverty. You can't send your children to school.
We'll also hear from some French citizens who aren't too happy about meatless school lunches.
For me, it's not a question of eating or not eating meat. It's a question of liberty, of choice.
All that and much more here on Living Planet. Stay tuned. First up, have you ever heard of speleology? Well, that was a new word for me this week, as I learned it's the scientific study of caves and other similar formations. But for those who explore and map caves, this is, of course, common knowledge. And some of those explorers are studying the largest glacial cave system in the contiguous United States. They want to learn how a warming climate is affecting glaciers and the caves within them, which have melted at an alarming rate, their magnificence diminishing into puddles. Researchers have been quickly trying to learn more about these caves since they were discovered in 2011 in the mountains outside Portland, Oregon. Tom Buchanan caught up with the cavers and glaciologists involved in this discovery to better understand what these caves meant to them, along with what losing them means for us and the planet. Here's his report from the slopes of the Cascades.
Not far from Portland, on Mount Hood's west side, looking east towards the summit, the mountain appears to cradle the Sandy Glacier in a valley between two steep, dominating spines. After a 5-mile or 8-kilometer hike uphill, most hikers would kick back here with a sandwich. But for some, reaching this point is just the beginning of the journey. In 2011, Brent McGregor and Eddie Cartaya, avid outdoorsmen and members of the National Speleological Society, a group dedicated to cave research and exploration, stumbled upon a YouTube video of a cavity in Sandy Glacier. They were immediately intrigued. Cartaya believed he had hit upon something big.
Once you see that, it's pretty much all you think about until you can get back there to it. Once you realize there is a discovery, an unmapped cave, you just feel kind of driven to make that your top priority. And that's pretty common throughout the caving community.
What they found were three distinct yet interconnected caves underneath the Sandy Glacier. The mountaineering pair named them Snow Dragon, Frozen Minotaur, and Pure Imagination. Besides soaking in the magnificent spectacle provided by sunlight diffusing through the ice cave's thin roof, the team took measurements in order to better understand how these caves are forming, changing, and melting in the face of global warming. Traditionally, our understanding of climate change impacts on glaciers has come from studying their surfaces. The Sandy Glacier caves allow us to understand the impacts of global warming from the inside out. Most caves like this form as a stream flows underneath a glacier, carving a channel out of the ice. In a delicate balancing act, the warmth from the water melts the glacier, while the pressure of the ice squeezes the cave shut. The addition of warm airflow through the cave melts even more of the glacier. Local glaciologist Andrew Fountain explains.
So you end up with a fairly large cave that started out as being melted out by water, but then later became enlarged just through the flow of warm air. And those are the caverns you can walk into.
Andreas Flitsch, a professor and expert in cave and extreme environment climatology at Ruhr University in Bochum, Germany, has been studying the Sandy Glacier Cave for the past 6 years. While taking measurements within the caves, Flitsch discovered something unexpected working against the cave's lifespan.
You go with shoes through the water, so you don't see if the water cold or warm. And when you do just different points of measurements, you might miss the warm springs. And with the thermal camera, we took a lot of thermal pictures, and I said, wow, the water is warm. So, and we found, I think, altogether more than 40 springs in the whole system. And that was amazing. We didn't expect this.
Fountain says this makes for a uniquely challenging situation for the Sandy Glacier.
Climate change causes the glaciers to shrink. So it's kind of a double whammy for these glaciers that they're getting melted from the top and getting melted from the bottom. So they're going to disappear much more quickly because of that.
And these glaciers are melting at an unprecedented rate. All that remains of the caves that Kartaya and the team uncovered a decade ago is rock. But fortunately, other caves do exist. If you climb high enough, it's still possible to pierce the glacier with an ice pick on Mount Hood. At around 7,000 feet, or 2,150 meters, the wind howls in your ears, and the snow stings any bits of exposed skin. The cave system has simply moved up the glacier into this frigid environment, Kartaya says.
So yes, the glacier is receding, meaning the toe, the lower end of it, is crumbling away and, you know, receding further and further up the mountain. As it does so, it's destroying that section of the cave. For example, the original snow dragon that we discovered in 2011, no longer, none of that passages exist. It's all rock, open to the air. However, as the glacier recedes, the passages form higher and higher and deeper into the glacier. So the recession is basically chasing the cave up into the glacier. It's kind of a very strange phenomenon, but the back of the cave goes deeper and deeper and deeper each year into the glacier as the front of it collapses.
Climate change has clearly been at play here. Professor Flitch says he recorded mountain surface temperatures up to 75 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 23 degrees Celsius, in June.
Global warming has an impact because when the cold periods is getting shorter in the winter and the warm period in the summer is getting longer, that means the freezing season is short, but the warming season is long. That means we have more time of warm air coming in.
In fact, these caves are the perfect illustration of how such dramatic climatic changes are playing out, says Kartaya.
The bigger question is, why are they significant? It's because it's a truly dramatic illustration of both climate and geologic change. It's a paleo archive, literally, of how climate is changing and how this ice mass is reacting. So it's a litmus paper. It's you can't really tell what day to day has climates change, or as the volcano changes its behavior underground, but the ice is indicative of that. And I think seeing something as dramatic as this level of recession on the Sandy Glacier, as well as many of the others around Mount Hood and other glaciated peaks in the area, speaks very strongly that, you know, there is change going on in our climate.
The watchful figure of Mount Hood with its ice cap brim has been a long-standing comfort to the people of Northwest Oregon. Ski-filled winters, and yes, even summers, have been made possible mostly by enduring glaciers. Striking mountainous landscapes and the aroma of Oregon pines await anyone willing to make the trek into Portland's backyard. But this environment is changing, and if we ignore what the data from these caves is telling us, we risk losing much more than glacier caves. From Portland, Oregon, for DW, I'm Tom Buchanan.
Now to France, where farmers have been demonstrating in front of Lyon City Hall after its new mayor banned meat from school cafeterias. It seems eating meat has recently become controversial in what many consider to be France's gourmet capital, and farmers and the food industry say they're under attack. While they protested, farmers were even handing out samples of beef, pork, lamb, and chicken. Reporting from France's third largest city, John Lawrenson has this story.
Farmers came to Lyon City Hall with goats, lambs, and cattle to protest the removal of meat from school menus. A banner read, "Stop ideology in our plates." Véronique Labi came with some of her cows from her farm just outside the city.
For me, it's
not a question of eating or not eating meat. It's a question of liberty, of choice.
Inside City Hall, new Green Party Mayor Grégory Doucet declined our offer of an interview. He didn't want to feed a new controversy, his spokeswoman said. He is, though, no stranger to controversy, such as when he refused to allow the Tour de France cycle race to stop in Lyon because it was, he said, macho and polluting. But in a written statement, he said he'd removed meat temporarily from school menus because of COVID-19. The statement said the measure allowed canteens to adopt a single menu, which speeded up lunch lines and made it easier to enforce social distancing measures. Madame Labi doesn't buy it.
No, because I have children who is going to school, not in Lyon. Distancing is respected and they eat meat. It's just a capacity of organization.
The reality, she says, is that the mayor is anti-meat. He has, she claims, banned pâté and ham from official reception buffets, something City Hall said it wouldn't comment on. At Claudius Bertellier, one of 129 schools where meat, though not fish or eggs, have been banned, parents like Stéphane Potta are upset.
It's a nonsensical decision. I was quite angry when I received the email about it from City Hall. Meat is an important source of protein, and our daughter doesn't much like fish or eggs. So when she comes home from school now, she's famished.
At a farmer's market on the outskirts of Lyon, a customer buys some chicken and a rib of beef. In these parts, say limousine, and people don't think car, they think breed of cow. Paul Bocuse, whom the Culinary Institute of America named Chef of the Century, came from here, whose signature dish was a chicken cooked in a pig's bladder. The French have a bit of a thing about meat. They like their beef bloody, and when it's pig, sheep, fowl or cow, eat bits that other nationalities would be squeamish about mentioning, let alone putting in their mouths. I get talking to the customer, whose name is Hubert Desmois. He tells me it's in the nature of the French to be omnivorous.
I think we have a meat culture. We eat the complete animal, from head to queue.
From head to tail,
sorry about that. Even the inside, the stomach, the kidney, everything. I think it's a very specific, I think, in France.
Back at City Hall, the protesting farmers are cooking up a barbecue for passers-by. There are plenty of takers. Though fewer than 2% of French people describe themselves as vegetarians, compared with 10% of Germans, a Harris poll shows 1 in 2 French people have reduced their meat consumption in the past 3 years. But if there's a retreat from meat, it's a slow and limited one, as the outcry here has illustrated. The mayor is promising to restore meat to school canteens, but will introduce a daily vegetarian option next year. John Lawrenson, DW, Lyon.
Turning from one debate about lifestyle choices to another, I'm now joined by my colleague Neil King, who's been reporting on the tourism industry for a new season of DW's podcast, On the Green Fence. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Sam.
So I am very interested in this season that is all about travel and tourism, especially as I'm thinking about all of the trips that I'm so excited to plan and go on once this lockdown stuff ends. So can you tell us a little bit about what you guys are all looking at, particularly in these first couple of episodes that are out?
Yeah, so, I mean, two sectors which, on the one hand, have been really hit hard by the pandemic, where business has really taken a hit, and on the other hand, are also considered the most unsustainable, where we're going to have to, you know, elicit real fundamental change if we want to reach carbon neutrality by 2050, which is the long-term goal. And so the first episode was about cruise shipping, one of the most unsustainable forms of travel. I mean, you go on an average cruise in the Mediterranean for a week and you're about 1.9 tons per passenger, right, for that week. So that is, it's just horrendous, the footprint that has, and it's very wasteful. But on the other hand, there's a lot of change happening in the cruise industry, and they're spearheading a lot of change, which could have a huge knock-on effect for shipping in general, which is a huge sector.
Yeah, so shipping as well is this massive industry that most of us don't see if we don't work in it.
It's a huge business, and they're all running on really, or most of them are running on really dirty fuel. They have these scrubbers in place, these filters to sort of, you know, take out the real dirt out of the air. But in terms of carbon emissions, there's literally very little happening in shipping to bring down those emissions. For instance, why don't we just reduce the speed?
Mm. I mean, cruise ships don't go super fast, right?
No.
But when it comes to shipping, they need to get places on a schedule.
Exactly. Cargo shipping, I mean, that's 90% of the world trade is transported on cargo ships. And they're just steaming ahead as fast as they can with these bunker fuels.
Mm.
And there are studies that show if you just reduce the speed by 10%, you can cut carbon emissions by 27%.
Mm.
And so for me, naive as I am, but that would sound like a very pragmatic solution. Let's just all slow down a bit, take 10% off, and we can reduce by, you know, 27% the carbon emissions. I mean, that would be great.
Sounds good. So that was number one. And then you also took a look at flying and flights, which we have talked about a lot. Mm. I have very mixed feelings about this. I don't know about you, but when it comes to flying, I mean, it's 2-3% of global emissions, which in some ways is a lot per person as an individual, but in other ways is a small slice of the pie, depending on how you choose to look at it.
Mm.
So where are you on flying now?
I'm always not in your shoes that I would have to go to the US where, I mean, how do you get there? You have to fly, right?
Right.
I mean, there's no other way. for me, it would be more like the UK or Ireland where I'd be going. But again, more often than not, I would fly to Ireland. I mean, going there by car, you'd have to take two ferries or it would just take ages.
Right.
I mean, this is the thing, the figure you also mentioned to begin with, because that was one thing where I sort of thought, you know, okay, 2-3%. Come on, is it really going to, you know, is that a deal breaker when it comes to reducing global warming? But yeah, I mean, one of the interview partners that I spoke to, I mean, she put it in a nutshell. She said, okay, it may just be 2-3%, but 80% of the world's population never sets foot in an aeroplane. So it is a tiny minority that is rather privileged that is producing 2-3%. And then it's, you know, and that 2-3% is more than certain countries put out.
Yeah,
so,
totally.
And that sort of puts it then a bit more in context where you sort of feel, okay, maybe we should rethink our approach to flying because, I mean, with all these budget airlines in Europe, I mean, it's just become so normal. I remember my very first flight as a kid, these budget airlines, they weren't around. And it was like, wow, I'm getting on a plane. And it was like, you know, Christmas come early. It was just unbelievable. And it was the thrill of it. And back then the flights were really expensive. You didn't do it often. And that's one of the upshots as well. I mean, the fact that nobody in this episode could explain to me, really, why is jet fuel not taxed?
Mm.
You know, there's some sort of opaque treaty from the 1940s where they all agreed on this to push aviation and they wouldn't tax it. And because it's so international, it's very difficult to do it. But nobody can justify that in times of global heating, why jet fuel isn't taxed. And so for that episode, I mean, we talked to airlines. We talked to the budget airline here in Europe, Ryanair. And we also talked to a US airline, United. That also got a bailout, you know, with the pandemic.
Yeah.
So, and we talked to them about their strategy. What are they doing to decarbonize? Because that's where things are going. That's where they have to go as well. And what options are on the table and how are they going to pull it off?
Yeah, it seems like some of these regulations or being part of a carbon market is going to have to be part of that solution to make them do that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one solution, but they have different strategies because that's also interesting. These two airlines, they've got a very different approach. With some, you know, offsetting schemes play a larger role. With some, they don't play a role.
I just want to know kind of your final takeaways on flying and cruises. How are you feeling about planning your own trips in the future?
It's a huge dilemma we're facing. Because if you look at tourism, it's pre-pandemic, it was growing at about 4-6% each year. It's a huge industry, about 10% of global GDP, so many, over 320 million jobs. I mean, just a bit of number crunching. It's just such a huge sector. And it's, I mean, let's face it, when the pandemic's over, we're going to go back to that.
Yeah.
People are just waiting to get out there and travel.
It's something I wonder, too, with groups that are trying to convince people not to fly or to travel less, is it's a difficult thing to ask people and perhaps kind of an elitist ask as well, because I feel like that's one thing that particularly as people move up in income, move into the middle class, is that's one of the things they're looking to do and be able to do is travel. And that's only going to happen more and more
I mean, you just put your finger on it, because if you look at, you know, countries like India or China, which are expanding, and we also had a business colleague from DW, an Indian business colleague, talk about this in the episode, the fact that hundreds of new airports are being built in these countries, they're going to go through the same development with budget flights as we did in Europe. It's going to grow, and the emissions are going to go through the roof. But who are we to tell them, you know, listen, guys, don't do as we did. You know,
yeah.
We know better now. We've seen the light. You've got to do this. I mean, what is that? We can't do that. Yeah, I think in this instance, it's technology that we really have to push. Mm. We have to show the way in terms of fuels. We have to make the alternative fuels cheaper, and we've got to put a really high price on carbon. There's a lot of debating going on just how to do this, but the industry has to be part of the solution, you know, when we're looking at these environmental issues.
Well, if you want to hear more of that debate and from some of those industry voices, check out On the Green Fence. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts, and it comes out every other week. So the first two episodes will be there for you. Thanks, Neil.
Thank you very much, Sam.
You're listening to Living Planet, coming to you from our studios in Bonn, Germany. Next, we turn to Nigeria's oil-producing Niger Delta, where locals have suffered from serious pollution and the health problems associated with it after several decades of oil production in the area. Women in traditional occupations like farming and fishing have endured some of the worst impacts, with many of them losing their livelihoods as oil pollution destroys both farmland and fishing grounds. But these women are taking a stand. Sam Olukoya has this report from the region.
Waves from the Atlantic Ocean hit the coast of Ibino, a fishing village in southeast Nigeria. A large gas flare burns close to the beach. There are lots of oil wells around the village. Gloria Alexander Thomas, who lives in Ibino, says that in the past, fishing thrived in the rivers around her village. The people say local fish stocks and other aquatic animal numbers have dwindled by more than three quarters over the years due to oil pollution in the waters around the village. She said people now depend on imported fish.
Right now, if you go to Ibono River to fish, you can't find anything. The pollution is what causes it. In fact, what we eat in Ibono now is either trawler fish that is gotten from other rivers, as in from other countries, or the common ice fish around. So the thing is really affecting the women, mostly the women.
Women from the Niger Delta region sing during a gathering to discuss the environmental problems facing their communities. The women say they bear the brunt of environmental problems in the region. Many of them make a living fishing, farming, or selling farm or fish products. They are mainly the breadwinners in many families where the men have traveled to the cities in search of jobs. They said their ability to provide for their families is reduced as annual fish catch and crop yields are dwindling due to environmental pollution from oil spills which affect their farms and fishing grounds. The busy Ibeno market is where Gloria used to make a living, buying and selling fish and other seafood around her village. Now, she says, her business has witnessed a downturn due to oil spills that have polluted the rivers around her village.
It has affected me because before now, I will be able to buy things, buy and sell fish, crayfish, periwinkle, but now, nothing to buy and sell. When there is no money, the situation is hunger, sickness, poverty. You can't send your children to school.
Nigeria is one of the world's largest oil producers. Virtually all the country's oil comes from the Niger Delta region. Oil extraction is mainly carried out by Western multinational companies and is linked to oil pollution, the main environmental problem affecting the Niger Delta. Between 300 and 3,000 oil spills occur in Nigeria yearly. In most instances, the spilled oil kills crops in farmlands or pollutes fishing areas. Dead fishes floating in oily water is a common sight. This pollution is enabled to happen by the government, which does not strictly enforce safety regulations. Professor Edem Achibong Enyang is from the Department of Forestry and Natural Environmental Management of the University of Uyo. He says environmental damage from the oil industry is a serious problem in the Niger Delta.
The environmental perturbations from the oil industry, oil spillage, damages done to oil facilities leading to pollution underwater, underground, on the surface, in the air, the gas flaring. It leaves us with an environment itself threatened with extinction. The landscape is under very serious threat. The people are threatened.
In Umechen village, a woman tills her farm. Here, most of the women make a living as farmers while their husbands travel to the cities to work. One of the women, Faith Amadi, says she has been witnessing dwindling yields on local farms over the years. She blames the situation on oil spills.
Before we were, our cultivations were fine, but now we started, you know, finding out what must have caused the reduction of our productions of in our agricultural systems. Then we found out that this thing was due to environmental or climate change, and then the pollutions. So we are fighting it bit by bit.
Evelyn Terundu of the Women Environmental Program says even though women bear the brunt of the environmental impacts from oil exploitation in the Niger Delta, little or no attention is paid to their plight.
The Niger Delta women are marginalized from the public space. Their voices are not taken into decision making. When you even go into communities to do a needs assessment and you invite the community leaders, most times women are excluded from those spaces. So women need to organize and mobilize. So when we come together in unity, we are better able to articulate our issues.
After years of being at the receiving end of environmental problems, women in the Niger Delta are now coming together to fight back. At a gathering of Niger Delta women organized by the Kabetkache Women Development and Resource Center, the slogan Women Power rings loud as the women express their determination to continue their campaign for a cleaner environment.
Thank you.
Welcome. There is an applause for Emen Okon, an environmentalist and women's rights activist who is at the forefront of mobilizing women in the Niger Delta.
We encourage them to record what is going on in their communities, talk about it and post it, share it on social media. So there is a lot of engagement going on.
Women in some communities are using their mobile phones to campaign against gas flaring. Gas flaring by oil companies is very common in the Niger Delta. There are reports of women who work near the gas flares suffering miscarriages and skin cancer. Okun says women have even gone a step further by starting to confront the oil companies that pollute their environment.
Women in River State, like in Abua, are engaging with companies that are operating in their communities to conduct environmental impact assessment. They even petitioned the company to the Commissioner for Environment, and the Commissioner convened a meeting. And we were there, and the Commissioner questioned the representatives of the company and asked them if they actually conducted environmental impact assessment.
It was a victory for the women, as the government granted their request. An environmental impact assessment will enable the women to state their concerns about the project. Niger Delta women sing about the need to forge a common front to confront the environmental problems that affect them. Even though they are beginning to find their voices in coming together to fight for environmental justice, there is still a long way to go. For DW, I'm Sam Olukoya in Nigeria.
And that's all for us on this week's edition of Living Planet. If you have environmental questions, we love to hear from you. Get in touch with us at livingplanet@dw.com. Thanks this week to our studio team, Ileana Gilarducci and Felix Heinzelman, and to Elliot Douglas and Charlie Shield for help with production. I'm Sam Baker. We'll be back next week with more environment stories from around the globe. Thanks for listening.